Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The grim numbers of COVID-19, a rising death toll, and a harsh financial reality. What you need to know as coronavirus lays siege to life as we know it in America. Then jobless claims in the U.S. double in a week. More than 6 million Americans seeking aid from the government, imposing a bleak and uncertain outlook for the economy. Plus, amid the staggering financial loss, we look at one of the hardest hit industries, restaurants, as employees are laid off and owners struggle to stay afloat.
We let go of all of our hourly employees. It was horrible. It was one of the hardest things I've had to do in my life.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Yet another momentous day in the relentless march of this pandemic. As of tonight, COVID-19 has infected more than 1 million people around the world and already left well over 50,000 dead. The U.S. count alone is nearly 6,000 dead, and President Trump has now ordered steps to make more ventilators available. White House officials say that he may also call for wearing face masks in hotspots. Meanwhile, there is fresh evidence that the U.S. workforce is suffering. We begin with this report from John Yang.
It's a two-front war. On the economic side, more than 6.6 million Americans filed their first claims for unemployment benefits last week as businesses nationwide closed their doors. The record numbers come as nearly 300 million Americans in 38 states plus Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia are under stay-at-home orders. On the medical front, doctors and nurses are pleading for more equipment like ventilators and protective gear known as PPEs like face masks. Emmanuel Bangan is a nurse at a hospital in San Jose, California.
We don't want to be spreading it ourselves, so we just want to have the right PPEs.
This afternoon, President Trump invoked the Defense Production Act to try to ramp up U.S. manufacture of ventilators. But earlier, the president questioned some requests for more equipment, tweeting, "Massive amounts of medical supplies, even hospitals and medical centers, are being delivered directly to states and hospitals by the federal government." He added, "Some have insatiable appetites and are never satisfied." Other officials say the need is real. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said his state is down to a six-day supply of ventilators. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker urged more action.
We are continuing to demand that this president step up and use his power and authority to help people in New Jersey and across this nation.
In Fort Lauderdale, two cruise ships carrying more than 200 ailing guests and crew finally docked after weeks in limbo, during which four people died. Officials said the healthy could go home and the sick would be treated on board. And late today, the Navy dismissed the commander of the USS Theodore Roosevelt, saying he went outside the chain of command when he raised alarm about an outbreak aboard the aircraft carrier. With hospitals reporting blood shortages as collection drives have been canceled amid social distancing, the FDA today relaxed donation restrictions for gay and bisexual men, those with recent tattoos or piercings, and recent visitors to areas where malaria is regularly found. Also today, the Democrats delayed their presidential nominating convention in Milwaukee by a month to August 17th. In a statement, the DNC said the delay gives convention planners more time to determine the most appropriate structure. The World Health Organization reported that more than 95% of Europeans who have died from coronavirus have been older than 60, but young people have still suffered severe cases. France, Italy, and Spain have been most affected in the outbreak. In Barcelona, empty coffins filled a parking garage turned warehouse today. Spain reported its one-day record of 950 deaths on Wednesday, but officials say the rate of infections there is slowing down.
The objective is to end this as quickly as possible so the rates don't continue to rise. It appears things are stabilizing. The deaths will stabilize later than the cases of new symptoms. But it is true that Spain has a bigger number of deaths that we would like to reduce as quickly as possible.
Next door in Portugal, barren streets on a sunny day in central Lisbon. Nearby, the Portuguese parliament voted to extend the country's state of emergency.
It is still necessary, and I would add even more necessary. Not because the number of new cases is not slowing down, but because as time passes, the risk is increasing.
And Russian President Vladimir Putin lengthened his country's non-working period until the end of April. That as cases in Russia have risen to 3,500. Moscow is in its fourth day of lockdown. Workers took advantage of the vast emptiness today, spraying disinfectant in usually bustling areas. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
And now to the surprise firing you just heard about of the captain of the USS Theodore Roosevelt. That's the U.S. Navy aircraft carrier that has been stricken by the pandemic. Nick Schifrin joins me now. So, Nick, tell us what's happened.
Yeah, Judy, this was a real extraordinary memo that the captain of the Theodore Roosevelt sent Brett Kozier. We saw that over the weekend. He said that more than 100 sailors on the Theodore Roosevelt were sick with COVID-19, and he couldn't keep them safe because of the conditions on board. They just simply work too closely together. And so he wanted 90% of the crew off immediately. He warned sailors could die. So today, we hear from Thomas Modly, the Navy Secretary, offense to two aspects of that memo. One, who it was sent to. He accused the captain of sending the memo to 20 or 30 people outside of the chain of command, and also the content of the letter. He said the captain's letter created panic on the ship, created panic among the families, because the first time they heard about this was when the memo was leaked to the media, and also misrepresented the moves the Navy was already taking in order to get some of those sailors off that ship. So let's listen to Thomas Modly, the acting Navy Secretary now.
I could reach no other conclusion that Captain Kozier had allowed the complexity of his challenge with the COVID breakout on the ship to overwhelm his ability to act professionally, when acting professionally was what was needed most at the time. We do, and we should, expect more from the commanding officer of our aircraft carriers.
And the acting secretary, Judy, it's important to say, did not accuse the captain of leaking the memo, only said that he sent it to so many people it could have been leaked.
And Nick, we know that you and your team have been in touch with the families of the sailors on that aircraft carrier. What are they saying?
Yeah, it really did create a panic among the families because, as I said, they heard about it for the first time from the media. And our producer, Ali Rogan, spoke to Debbie, whose daughter is still on board. Let's take a listen.
We deserve to have a government that is honest and truthful with us about where our enlisted folks are, where are the people who are protecting our country, and that they're protected, and that they're safe, and that they are out of harm's way. And the fact that we are not being communicated to in a transparent and forthright way is a problem.
And we spoke to Debbie before the announcement just in the last hour, Judy, but it really goes to show how angry the families were. They did not feel like the Navy was communicating to them. And the acting Navy Secretary admitted that he lost control of the narrative, could not communicate with the families or the sailors directly. Instead, everyone read that memo in the media, and in part, that's why the captain of Theodore Roosevelt has been fired.
One more development in this very fast-moving story. Nick Schifrin, thank you very much. The White House briefing is still underway at this hour, and we'll be talking with Yamiche Alcindor about the latest on masks and any other new guidelines later in the program. But first, despite the pain that U.S. workers are feeling because of the pandemic, Wall Street rallied today as oil prices jumped 25%. This came after President Trump suggested that Saudi Arabia and Russia might back off a price war. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 470 points. To close at 21,413. The NASDAQ rose 126 points, and the S&P 500 added 56. The scale of job losses today is unprecedented. More than 10 million people in 2 weeks. And many economists say there are many more yet who are not even being counted. We are going to take a deeper look, but let's start with the voices of some of those who have been laid off or furloughed. Here's a small sampling from viewers who got in touch with us.
My name's Juliana. I'm 24. I live on the east side of Milwaukee. Before all this, I had two different service industry jobs. There was about a week span of time where I was just like getting called off of my shifts. Eventually, they did end up closing.
My name is Lyda Parker Sylvester, and I live in Chicago, Illinois. I worked for 25 years in the hospitality industry, so hotels, an event planner. So when all this mess went down, like late March, we were furloughed.
My name is Jason Krujewski. I am from Denver, Colorado. And before this COVID-19 began, I was a biomedical designer. And 2 weeks ago today, I was let go of my position.
My name is Adrian Trujillo. I am from Seattle, Washington. It sucks to lose a job. You know, I have bills and stuff. So that was a concern, of course. That was immediate. My God, I don't have a job.
I'm Ginger Garner. I live in Greensboro, North Carolina. I am a physical therapist by training, and I am self-employed. So I had just reopened my clinical practice. The decision to close my doors was very difficult because then that shuts you off from serving those patient populations.
My name is Ashley, and I live in New York City. The process to get the unemployment application accepted has been very difficult. I was furloughed officially on the 23rd of March, and I still haven't been able to submit my application completely. And I spent hours trying to call the unemployment offices. And so far, after 300 plus calls and hours on the line, I haven't been able to reach a single person on at the unemployment office.
I didn't expect this to affect myself. Unfortunately, right now, my wife and I, we're expecting our first child on April 26th as of right now. I applied for unemployment, started applying for unemployment anyways, a couple hours after the news that my job was no longer needed at the moment. I still have yet to hear from the state of Colorado with any confirmation.
I have been looking for other employment, but it has been a struggle too as well, because you have millions of people looking for the minimum amount of jobs that are out there.
I think a lot of small business owners are frankly worried about, if they're like me, I don't know if I'll last till July. Applying for a loan in a regular environment is stressful, but doing it in this kind of climate where you know you might not survive if you don't get it is really heart-wrenching.
I have a son, he's 10 months old. I'd have to pay for his health insurance as well as mine without having a paycheck. And we had to take out a loan just because formula is so expensive. It ended up being $900, but we took out a loan and we pay it monthly. So that's something else I have to worry about.
Credit card payments, loan payments are all late. You obviously amass many late fees with those. If this goes on for another month or two, I mean, how am I supposed to, you know, really recover from that?
I've never experienced anything like this. I lived through 9/11. Within the hotel industry. So, and we did pretty well recovering, but I'm very nervous about this one. And I think we as a country need to have a conversation of what are we gonna do to help people? Help people and make sure that our bills are being paid and that there is income coming in.
The views of just many of our viewers. So let's take a broader look now at the economic pain this coronavirus crisis is delivering. I'm joined by Laura Tyson, an economist and professor at the University of California at Berkeley. She also served as chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors and as director of the National Economic Council during the Clinton administration. Laura Tyson, welcome back to the NewsHour. This is so massive. Give us a sense of what the American worker can now look forward to in terms of having a job, being able to count on a paycheck. What are they looking at?
It's important first to note that this is going to be the second quarter of 2020. We'll probably see the biggest decline in GDP production that we've witnessed since World War II, since 1933. There are different measures. It's really, really big. This is an induced cut back, an induced shutdown. All of those people that spoke across all kinds of industries, all kinds of skill levels, all kinds of ages, you just heard, are affected because we now have essentially 90% of the population on some form of shutdown. So that's the reality. The question is, can we get through this in a quarter or a quarter or two and then come out into recovery?
But how do we know that it's going to be a quarter? I mean, at this point, we think the virus will run its course. But there's so many unknowns at this point. I think a lot of people are afraid it's not going to be over in a matter of 3 months.
I think that is a fear that we all need to live with. I think we don't know for sure, because remember, for everyone, we are in this recession because we are trying to battle the only way we know how. This virus. And it is possible that the social distancing and closed down mechanisms we will use will create enough time so we get some effective treatment, not a vaccine, but a treatment. So we get testing, because you cannot let people go back without prevalent testing. You just can't. So, and to get the hospitals better equipped. So let's think about this quarter as a quarter where we're kind of closing the economy down to build up our defenses against the virus. And if we do that, it will make coming out sooner and a bit easier.
And in the meantime, Laura Tyson, the government there's this massive relief bill that was passed. The president signed it last week, $2.2 trillion. When does that turn into tangible relief for people like those we were just listening to? And by the way, what about the unemployment insurance, the unemployment benefits they're going to be counting on?
Right. So first of all, let me just put this in magnitude, because we have essentially, I kept talking about the quarter we're in, the second quarter. If you look at the amount of stimulus that is going to be injected from that bill in this period, it's the biggest we've ever had by far. Okay, we're talking about in a quarter, something like 20% of GDP we're going to be putting in as a stimulus. So it's a big deal. Now, what your interviewees said is correct. It is very hard to execute this quickly. So yes, the unemployment compensation rules, which have basically generated a significant amount of potential for the unemployed support, but getting that is difficult. And I know that state governments, I know my own state, is beginning to move their own officials around to go from one part of government service to another so they can man and women those unemployment offices. So yes, there's going to be an execution problem. What I would encourage everyone to do is to keep searching. You will find that if you, all of those people who have bona fide unemployment positions will be able to get support, but it is going to be difficult and a bit slow. Many hours on the phone, many hours filling out forms.
We heard that young woman say she had made over 300 phone calls to the unemployment office and still wasn't able to get through.
Yes, no, it's really, again, the sudden nature of this. And the widespread nature of it, for it happens so fast that people have a job one day and the next day they're told they can't go to work, and the next day they're told they're furloughed or they're unemployed. So the numbers and speed have basically made it extremely difficult for the agencies, which exist in normal times to process something like unemployment claims, to do it as rapidly as possible. All I can say is that for the individual, it's sticking with it because there is relief there. And for the states and local governments, I know they are trying to figure out ways to increase the ability of their offices to execute the policies.
Well, it's a crisis the likes of which we couldn't have even imagined before now. And I know we are looking for any way we can to give information to people who are out there and suffering and worried. Laura Tyson, thank you very much. One of the many sectors of the economy that is getting hit especially hard is the restaurant industry. In normal times, Americans were spending roughly as much at restaurants each year as they were at grocery stores. Our economics correspondent Paul Solman looks at how this is affecting a few restaurants in the greater Washington, D.C. area. His report is part of our regular series, Making Sense.
We let go of all of our hourly employees. It was horrible. It was one of the hardest things I've had to do in my life.
John Williams owns Whitlow's, a bar and grill in Arlington, Virginia, not far from the NewsHour, that's been closed since mid-March.
The hardest thing is letting all these people who've busted their butts for you for years and just being like, I gotta let you go. I can't do this. I can't keep the train going forward with everybody on it. And that sucks.
Williams, whose brother works at the NewsHour, now serves only non-paying customers.
I got one dish.
His former employees.
That's for you, buddy.
Thank you. I ordered like eggs and milk and bread and stuff, just the basics, so they can, you know, so they can get by. And we'll just distribute that out to everybody every week. I mean, it's something.
The pandemic has closed restaurants here, there, and everywhere. Since March 1st, the industry, which employs 16 million Americans, about 10% of the workforce, has axed 3 million jobs and counting. Most restaurants expect more layoffs this month. Catherine McGee has been a bartender for 12 years. The mom of two lost her job at Whitlow's last month.
I don't have a salary. I can't get sick leave or vacation pay. We make all of our money off of cash tips. So it's a huge blow monetarily when you're told one day you just can't work. How do you pay for rent? How do you pay your bills? How do you pay for your car? If you have to use your car, how do you pay for your kids?
For 22-year-old Brianna Euler, a Whitlow's server, her job wasn't the only thing she lost.
One of my family members were laid off as part of the pandemic. They were for like a big company and they're laying off a bunch of workers because it's slow. And so my whole family lost their health insurance also. That's probably the craziest part of all of this, is to lose your health insurance in the middle of a worldwide pandemic where people like definitely need health insurance if things were to go wrong.
The financial aid bill signed into law last Friday will offer some relief. $600 a week in federal unemployment to restaurant workers to supplement state benefits. For the restaurants themselves, small business loans with forgiveness provisions.
That's going to save our business, and it's going to save, I know, lots of other businesses. I mean, I slept this weekend for the first time because I was up all night, all last week, just trying to figure everything out. And on Friday, you know, there was a glimmer of hope. Those loans are going to keep everybody going. And that's going to put food on everyone's table, including mine.
How long can you stay out of business before you don't have a business?
I don't know. I don't know how long I can.
Andy Shalal owns 7 Busboys and Poets restaurants in the Washington, D.C. area.
In the hospitality industry, very thin margins. And so you're basically skating by during the wintertime. And you're hoping that the spring will make up for the difference of what you lost during the winter. This is the worst time ever. I mean, it's no exaggeration that we may have 30% or up to 50% of restaurants will not be able to come back.
Busboys and Poets is still open for takeout, but Shalal's had to lay off 90% of his staff, some 500 people, including event specialist Brandy Jackson, who quickly applied for unemployment insurance, was sent the wrong forms, called to get the right ones.
The first time I was on hold for about 4.5 hours before it got disconnected. I started over. The second time I was on for about 5-ish hours. I haven't had any luck getting through to this day. This is my 4th day calling.
So if you're not getting unemployment yet, obviously, and you can't even get on the rolls yet, how are you going to survive?
The good thing is that at least for my rent in my building has been pushed back, and I did receive one last paycheck from Busboys. So right now, that is all I have. And I mean, if we could just be total honest, that's not going to last me more than after this week, after groceries.
Owner Shalal says he's waiting on details to determine if government aid will be enough to save his business.
You still have your rent, you still have your electricity, you still have your taxes, you still have all these other things that continue and don't stop. We pay yesterday's bills with today's revenue. And if today's revenue stops, that avalanche of payables is relentless. If we're talking 4 weeks, we're probably okay. If we're talking much more than that, all bets are off.
David Guas closed Bayou Bakery in Arlington this week, laying off all but four of his 23 employees. But the New Orleans native is still cooking. Guas teamed up with nonprofit Real Food for Kids to give away free, healthy meals to children in the neighborhood and others in need.
We had one targeted school that's about five blocks away from us, Key Elementary. I have at least six or seven of my staff whose kids go to Key Elementary who are on the reduced meal programs and the free meal programs. So I'm staring at who's going to be affected. I've got plenty of big pots, you know, from all my crawfish boils. So I set up all the propane tanks outside and started just cooking.
Decorated takeout bags no longer used for orders now adorn Guas's windows. And this week, Shalal helped paint the windows of his shuttered restaurants.
The sidewalks are generally empty, but when people walk around, they feel like they're just kind of in a daze. And sometimes you need to have some joy, some interruption that is positive in your day as you're walking to see some beauty or some message that is inspiring.
For the PBS NewsHour, this is correspondent Paul Salmon, still reporting from home.
In the day's other news, Iran dismissed President Trump's claim that it is planning an attack on U.S. targets in Iraq. On Twitter, Foreign Minister Javad Zarif wrote, "Iran starts no wars, but teaches lessons to those who do." Mr. Trump said Wednesday that U.S. intelligence believes Iran and its proxies mean to strike in Iraq, but he gave no details. A court in Pakistan has rejected the murder conviction of the accused mastermind in the Daniel Pearl killing. The Wall Street Journal reporter was kidnapped and beheaded in Pakistan in 2002. Ahmed Omar Saeed Sheikh has already served 18 years in prison and could now be released. Prosecutors say they will appeal. The top Democrat in the U.S. Congress called today for strict oversight of some $2.2 trillion in economic emergency relief spending during the pandemic. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced plans for creating a bipartisan committee. She said it would have subpoena power to guard against waste and price gouging.
We think that it would be very important with transparency, bipartisanship, accountability, that we proceed all together in a way that unifies our country, addresses the concerns that we have about the health and well-being of the American people, the safety of our workers who are meeting their needs, as well as the impact on our economy.
Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said this evening he does not believe that a new oversight committee is necessary. Polio eradication efforts are being halted globally amid the coronavirus pandemic. The World Health Organization and its partners announced today they've suspended vaccination campaigns for the next 6 months. Polio remains a problem in about a dozen countries. Video conferencing on the technical app Zoom has mushroomed during the pandemic, but its CEO had to apologize today for a series of security lapses. The FBI has warned of hackers invading school sessions on Zoom, and NASA and SpaceX have now banned all use of the service. Zoom says that daily usage has jumped from 10 million people in December to 200 million now. And the COVID-19 crisis claimed three music figures of note in the last 24 hours. Jazz pianist Ellis Marsalis died at 85. His sons, Wynton and Branford, are also acclaimed musicians. Emmy and Grammy winner Adam Schlesinger was a musician and songwriter. He was 52. And jazz guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli backed musical legends from Benny Goodman to Paul McCartney. He was 94. Still to come on the NewsHour from the front lines, how racism and inequity are magnifying the pandemic's fallout. On the NewsHour bookshelf, a White House reporter's new memoir, Front Row at the Trump Show, and what to watch on television with almost all of our time now spent indoors.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
COVID-19 is forcing all of us to live in new ways. But as Amna Nawaz reports, it is also exposing longstanding rifts in American society. This story is part of our ongoing series, Race Matters.
Officials have said over and over again, the virus doesn't discriminate. But the disparities that have long been part of our medical system in America are now leading to what some call a crisis within a crisis. Black and brown communities across the country being hit harder, in greater numbers, and with fewer resources to save them. For more on this, I'm joined by Dr. Uche Blackstock. She was an associate professor of emergency medicine at New York University. She now runs a consultancy firm called Health Advancing Equity and practices in urgent care clinics in Brooklyn, New York. Dr. Blackstock, welcome to the NewsHour. Start by just telling us about the patients you're seeing right now. What are they telling you? What are their symptoms? How sick are they?
So currently I work out of an urgent care clinic in central Brooklyn where the population is largely Black and brown, and we've really been seeing patients over the last one to two weeks come in progressively sicker, a lot with fever, cough, worsening shortness of breath, some even sick enough to warrant emergency department visits.
And are you seeing any kind of trend in their symptoms? Do you know that these are coronavirus cases?
They're absolutely textbook COVID-19 cases. I mean, down to the type of symptoms, the course of the symptoms, the onset of worsening of symptoms, every patient after the next coming in with the exact same story. It's almost uncanny.
You know, Dr. Blackstock, you had told me that before the pandemic even hit, you were worried that those same patients you serve in your community were going to be hit harder. Why is that?
For multiple reasons. I mean, even thinking about the testing criteria that was initially being used to determine whether or not someone had exposure to COVID-19, it included the person needed to have traveled abroad to one of the countries where COVID-19 was endemic, like Italy or China. Also required someone having to know someone who had tested positive. And what we knew very early on was that, you know, there were communities that did not have access to testing. We had heard of celebrities and politicians having very easy access to testing and quick turnarounds. And these are communities that already carry very high chronic disease burdens like diabetes, high blood pressure, asthma. There are also high rates of obesity. And, you know, these have all been tied into racial health disparities linked to structural racism. So it's already kind of made these patients and these communities more vulnerable to COVID-19, as we're seeing that these patients are at increased risk for developing very serious complications.
You know, it has been studied and documented, as you just mentioned, the racial bias in our medical system, not just in access to care, right, but in how Black and brown people are treated once they're in care. As the cases spread further, as people get sicker, how are you worried, or what are you worried will happen as a result of all of those institutional biases and how that'll affect your patients?
Right. And, you know, what we already know, as you alluded to, is that when, you know, Black and brown people interface with the healthcare system, they often encounter provider bias. So we know, and it's well documented, that their pain is undertreated or their complaints are minimized. So my concern is that when these patients present to emergency departments and hospitals in their areas with COVID-19 symptoms, that their symptoms may be downplayed or they may not be taken seriously. And we do already have the data to support that trend continuing to happen.
You know, we're talking before the peak in New York has even arrived. What do you think your community is going to look like, those communities in which your patients live a week from now or 2 weeks from now or 3 weeks from now?
I'm scared. I'm scared that these communities are going to be
absolutely ravaged and devastated by COVID-19. I mean, when I think about how each day last week, I just saw sicker and sicker patients. It was significant, and it was also terrifying. And so I do worry, and we already actually have some of the preliminary data out today in the New York Times, that our poorer areas of the city, which are mostly black and brown, have the heaviest number of patients that have been affected with coronavirus.
Dr. Blackstock, you, of course, have a family at home, too. Yeah. You have a husband, you have two young kids. I wonder if you can tell me how you're processing this right now, whether you're scared for your own safety or theirs.
Thank you for asking. I will readily admit that I am scared. I'm scared about being infected myself. I'm scared about bringing disease home to my husband and my two small children. I've had to have very difficult conversations with my family recently, including one with my husband the other night, where once I realized things were really shifting here in New York City, you know, I said to him, you know, there's a chance that I may not make it out of this working on the front line. And, you know, I want you to know that I love you. I love our children very much. And just please make sure that they always know that their mama loved them. And so these are conversations that not just I'm having, but many of my colleagues are having with their families as well.
Thank you for sharing that with us, and thank you for the work that you do. That's Dr. Uche Blackstock joining us tonight from New York.
Thank you for having me.
President Trump's complicated relationship with the press has been on full display for weeks at his administration's daily coronavirus briefings. He sometimes seeks out reporters he deems friendly while going toe-to-toe with those he accuses of treating him unfairly. As ABC News chief White House correspondent Jonathan Karl has a close-up view of this administration, which he writes about in his new book, Front Row at the Trump Show. And John Karl joins us now. Thank you for joining us on the NewsHour. John, let me ask you first to put on your hat as president of the White House Correspondents Association. What do you say to those who look at these briefings and say they've become as much about politics as they have about information? What does that mean as a challenge for reporters?
You have daily briefings with the president sometimes speaking for holding forth for up to 2 hours with reporters in that room. Clearly has been a political message as well as a really important public health message. So I think, Judy, there's really two ways to look at this. One, should these briefings be carried live, you know, from beginning to end by the various networks? The second question is, should we as White House reporters be covering them? The second question to me is a very easy one. We have to be there. We have access to the president. We have access to the vice president, who is the head of the coronavirus task force. We have access to the top public health officials. These are important. We have important questions. I think there is information that comes out of this, out of these briefings, that is very important. But let's face it, there's a lot of politics here. There has been a lot of disinformation that has come out as well. So it is our duty as reporters and frankly as networks to put context and to correct misinformation. And whether or not they're carried live, I think that's a legitimate debate that should be held but done in newsrooms at all of the networks.
Do you have a view about whether they should be carried live or live streamed, which is what news organizations do?
It's not simply tracking the ins and outs of politics. This is essential. People want essential information for how to deal with this crisis, how to keep themselves safe, how to keep our families safe. So, I think it'd be a pretty tough decision to say no live coverage whatsoever. There's clearly an appetite, and you can see that with the large numbers of people that are watching these briefings.
The president, as you know, John, has gone after a number of reporters, including our own Yamiche Alcindor. We're proud of the way she's conducted herself. What about when he's gone after you and others? I mean, how should reporters process this?
The president has made some outrageous attacks on her, has responded in strange ways to perfectly legitimate questions by attacking her personally. And I think that what Yamiche has done is what I have done, I've tried to do as well, which is don't take the bait. This is not about us and the president. This is about trying to get real information out of this administration. trying to hold the president accountable, trying to ask pertinent questions that people want to know, especially during this time. But I think that the danger here, when he attacks, one of the reasons why he attacks us, Judy, is because he wants people to see us as his opposition. You know, he has been explicit about this. He has said the media is the opposition party. So if he gets people to believe that, then as he told Leslie Stahl famously in 2016, they won't believe it when you do negative stories about me. So, you know, we have to be careful in responding to not take the debate and not to turn this into a battle between us and the president, because that is not what it is.
So is there a proper response for that on the part of the press when that is the goal of the president?
The proper response is to keep asking the questions, regardless of whether or not they're going to draw personal attacks from the commander-in-chief. Regardless of whether or not he is going to pop off at a press conference, we ask our questions, we do our reporting, we don't take it personally, which, by the way, is not easy sometimes. Some of these attacks have been deeply offensive, but I think that they don't matter in the scheme of things. It doesn't matter if the president calls me a name. As Yamiche knows, it doesn't matter if the president's going to try to talk over her. She will hold her ground and continue to ask her questions, and so will I.
You, Jonathan, have covered this president since the early 1990s, and you write about that in the book. You were a reporter in New York. You've known him a long time. Is this the same person with the same approach to the truth, to the facts, that you knew then that he is now?
I had my first meeting with Donald Trump way back in 1994, and it was a phenomenal set of circumstances where I basically just cold called him, the general number to the Trump organization, and pitched the story. He got back to me within an hour. I was a nobody. I was a junior reporter for the New York Post. I'd been on the job for just a few months. He had no idea who I was, but he welcomed me in, you know, treated me to this whole up and down tour of Trump Tower at a time when Michael Jackson was having his honeymoon there with Lisa Marie Presley, and it was this crazy paparazzi story in New York. He brought me in. But, you know, I'll tell you, in some ways, he has changed not at all. As a matter of fact, Judy, if you don't mind, I'm going to show you a picture from that day when I first met him. This was in Trump Tower. Huh. And it's me and Donald Trump. And I had lost this picture. It was in a box in the basement for about two decades. When he became president, I pulled it out. And I look at it now, and I see almost exactly the same guy. He's got the red tie that's a little too long, the same suit, the same grin, the same, you know, the hair is a little bit different, not much. And the attitude is almost exactly the same. Back then, the thing that he seemed to want to do the most was to make himself the center of the story, which is why he invited some unknown reporter in to talk to him, because it was a chance to be a part of what was a very big story in New York at the time. And now that's the way he is now. He sees things in almost exactly the same way, and his personality, I think his style, has actually changed remarkably different, although I certainly had no idea that that guy that I met 26 years ago would go on to become president.
Jonathan Karl, the book is Front Row at the Trump Show. John Karl, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Judy.
At the White House this evening, a sign that the administration may change their recommendation and say that Americans should wear protective face masks. Our Yamiche Alcindor is here now to fill us in on the latest. Yamiche, are they saying more about that this evening?
Yes, White House officials and President Trump are expected to make a major change in guidance related to how Americans can protect themselves against the coronavirus. They're expected to recommend that Americans that are living in hot spots or areas that are hardest hit by the coronavirus, that those people should wear cloth face masks. Now, that's different from the N95 masks that healthcare workers use and the ones that are in dire shortage for them. They still want those kind of masks to be focused on healthcare workers, but they're going to be asking Americans who are in community spread areas that are hardest hit by the virus to do that. This is a major reversal. The CDC had not been recommending this. I'm told that an announcement is expected in the next day or so, or possibly this weekend. It hasn't happened yet, but my sources at the White House tell me that it is coming fairly soon.
Well, I know you will be reporting.
And the other thing I should note,
go ahead.
Oh, I should just say the other thing I should note, Judy, is that the president has also taken a second test for the coronavirus. He tested negative again. Here's what he had to say about that.
It took 14 minutes or something to come up with a conclusion, and it said the president tested negative for COVID-19. So that's the second one. I think I took it really out of curiosity to see how quickly it worked and fast it worked, and it's a lot easier. I've done them both, and the second one is much more pleasant.
And Yamiche, we know, and of course, everyone's relieved the president still testing negative. We also know that the president and the people around him talked today about the use of the Defense Production Act. What are they saying about that?
Well, Judy, the Defense Production Act, as we've been explaining since this outbreak began, is an act that would allow the president to direct companies to make essential medical equipment as the government needs it. In this case, the president had only used it for one company, General Motors, and only for ventilators. He's now expanding that. He's going to be using it for other companies, including GE and a company named 3M. And it's going to be expanded to other items, including masks and ventilators. So the president is using his powers to direct companies, enforcing them, essentially, to make these contracts and make these goods for the American people. The other thing to note is that governors have been asking for a long time for the president to expand the role that he was playing when it comes to this needed medical equipment. So governors are going to be welcoming this, but it's still not the president making a blanket statement that he's going to be doing that for other medical equipment like gowns and other things.
And finally, Yamiche, we gather there were a lot of questions and answers tonight about this economic relief to people who are so hard hit by what's happened with the loss of jobs. What are they saying?
That's right. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is saying that within the next 2 weeks, Americans who have direct deposit information already with the federal government, that they will start receiving those checks, the $1,200 per people per American, as well as $500 per child. That's going to start hitting people's bank accounts. But the thing to note is that people who don't have direct deposit information, who get paper checks, White House officials today told me that those people could wait up to 20 weeks, nearly 5 months, for those checks. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is saying he's hoping Americans don't have to wait that long, that he's hoping it's going to be weeks, not months. But it's critical for people who don't have direct deposit information and who are eligible for those checks to get their information to the government as soon as possible.
Well, I know people are hanging on this information, so important for so many Americans. Yamiche, thank you. With so many of us sheltering at home, it is no surprise that television viewing, especially streaming video, has seen a dramatic rise. A recent Nielsen analysis showed an 85% rise in streaming from a year ago and a steady increase week to week in March. But what to watch? Jeffrey Brown gets some recommendations from Los Angeles Times critic Lorraine Ali for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Well, Lorraine Ali, thanks so much for joining us. Let's talk first about the moment we're in. Television is one thing that really hasn't changed for people.
Right. I mean, when you look at what's going on, you can't really go to concerts anymore. You can't go to see a film in a theater. And really what's there for us is television. And that whole idea that we had maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, there's so much, I'll never be able to see it all. Well, now we're actually in the unfortunate situation where, yes, we do have the time and we are home and we can see it all. So, you know, it is there for us now.
So help us out. So a few recommendations. Let's start with something new, some new dramas, a couple of them.
There's a great new drama on Netflix called Unorthodox, and it's based on a book by a woman who lived in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in Brooklyn.
Where I come from, there are many rules.
And escaped her marriage, fled to Berlin, tries to start a secular life there, and it's just sort of about that whole challenge of leaving that community and then also that community coming back after her. Not lighthearted, but certainly takes you into another world.
Okay, one more?
I would say Hulu's A Little Fires Everywhere. kind of a nighttime soap opera, if you will. Reese Witherspoon, Kerry Washington, about class, race, and the American dream flipping it on its head. Not deep and heavy, but definitely kind of like some good stuff to sink into.
Now, one kind of real escapism would be taking us outdoors. That would be animal and nature shows, right?
Oddly enough, one of the things I really like to watch when I just kind of want to unwind is Dr. Paul, who's on Nat Geo Wild. I think there's something like a billion seasons of it. But he is a vet in rural Michigan, goes out to farms, has his own practice, and you kind of follow him and his team. And while it sounds a little goofy, it's really nice not to have people drama. It's animals, and it's saving animals, and it's people being able to do something. Another one on Animal Planet's called Secret Life at the Zoo, and it kind of takes you behind the scenes at the zoo.
Today, the pups are being microchipped.
The excellent part is you also have Olivia Colman, who is your narrator. So it's got this kind of high end of a really A-list actor in there.
There's a true crime docuseries called Tiger King that's getting a lot of attention. Tell us about that one.
Sure. It's one of those Netflix docuseries where truth is really weirder than fiction in this case.
My name's Joe Exotic and this is Sarge.
A big cat breeder in Florida, meaning tigers, lions, gets caught up in this whole murder for hire scheme. It's just this cast of really eccentric characters, and it kind of goes deeper and deeper into this very, very strange subculture, and it is fascinating.
And nobody's going to tell me any otherwise.
As you said, we all have a lot more time. What about old familiars, something to just, so sort of the comfort food of television?
One of my favorites is a British detective series. It's called Father Brown.
Thank God you're here.
And again, there's like a billion episodes of it, and you're following a father who solves crimes. And it's really, really comforting, but he's also solving these murders in this tiny little town where lots of murders seem to happen all the time.
You were telling me before we started that there are, of course, all these series that are very specifically set in cities. Many of us now cannot go walk around our own cities.
While we're sequestered in our houses and missing our city outside, if you're in LA, Insecure is really great for that. It takes you all over the city. In Atlanta, of course, is great for that. You know, in D.C., I think Veep, as depraved as Veep was, it takes you all over D.C., or Master of None for New York. They take you kind of into this real locals places and also the bigger kind of landmarks.
What about for people who just really want to go right there into pandemic scare mode? There's plenty for them too?
I don't understand that, but I can say there is plenty out there. And now the ratings on these are soaring as well. Containment, 2012, pandemic. All of the streamers have something out there for you. Though seriously, I really recommend just watching a cute animal show because I don't know how you can do that right now.
I know you're always looking ahead and it looks like we might be in this situation for a while. Are there things you want us to be on the lookout for?
So coming up is this great series called Mrs. America. It's FX Hulu and it's starring Kate Blanchett. And it's kind of looking at the women's equality movement in the early 70s. It's excellent. Rose Byrne plays Gloria Steinem. So that's going to be out in a couple weeks, and that's something to look forward to.
Okay, recommendations for what to watch. Lorraine Ali from the LA Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I love the puppies. What else can I say? And that's a NewsHour for tonight. It's a good way to end the program. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.